Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Help. Hello and welcome to what I promise will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, George P. Fraser. When he was growing up, if something went wrong, it was usually George's fault. George, welcome.
I wrecked everything,
yeah,
Bill.
We
couldn't have anything nice because
couldn't. Yeah.
Talent.
Oh, I know. So you got a long history of messing things up, but you know, God puts it all back together, doesn't he?
Yeah, and one of the miracles of this program is that we're going, what are we going into, our ninth this month?
Ninth in, yeah, I think it's this March. Yeah. Well, March, yeah, it's nine
I
months.
Thought I'd
nine,
missed
nine,
this.
9 months. 9 years. Anyway, boy, we're off to a good start, aren't we?
Well, our typical start. You want to talk about a step?
Yeah,
or?
I want to talk about step three. I think it's an important one, and you know more about it than I do, so go ahead.
I don't know about that, but we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. And we understand him to be Jesus Christ, because that is the one true God, the only way to God. I was at Salvation Army this week and running a group, and one of the guys was talking about expectations. And I got a thought from God that this is something that I think we need to talk about. What happens for a lot of guys when they get into recovery, Bill, they come in out of consequences, jail, relationship, job, or all of the above in my case, and we decide, well, I'll give this up, but here's what I want to get out of it. And if I don't get this, I'm not going to stay with it. When we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, we're making a decision to do his will and not our will. And where we constantly mess up, even if we're sober many years or we're mature Christians for many years, I wouldn't know about being a mature Christian, I'm a Christian, but I need to get this out of it to keep it going rather than to do God's will. And Bill, I see, as you have working with guys over the years, they start off really well. And if they don't get their deal that they've negotiated with God, it's very conditional. If my wife doesn't come back to me, I'm not staying in recovery. If I don't get out of jail, you know, if I don't get a downward departure, I'm not going to do it. You got to be all in on this. And the let go, let God, you know, we always hear that. What does that mean? What that means is you let go of the result. You still have to do the effort. But we're going to trust God. And that's really hard for a lot of people. And what this step is not just giving your drinking or drug problem or your sex problem or gambling problem to God, it's your whole life. And it's a tall order. And before you do it, take a real note of whether you're ready to do that. You have to pray for Jesus' help to do that, Bill. Otherwise, it's impossible. And that's what I wanted to talk about tonight, because I see so many guys get disrupted on that this wasn't what they thought it was going to be because they didn't get what they want. And what you got to start with is you don't know what you want. Because if you did, you wouldn't be an addict. And the hard part about, you know, getting sober is step one, where we admit we're powerless. It's not just when we use. It's the fact that we still want to use even though it's killing us. That's where the real powerlessness comes in. And when you get some sanity, which comes from the Holy Spirit, and you're ready to turn your life over to the care of God as you understand him, that means praying only for knowledge of his will for you and the power to carry that out of step 11. God, what do you have for me to do today? And I see a lot of people get messed up on that. Your thoughts?
Well, this step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. This is a transformational step with your mind, where you go from thinking about concepts to actually carrying them out. It's a big open door to getting your will in line with your will of the Lord in your life.
Right.
That's not an easy one.
No, I'm really good at doing God's will when it aligns with mine.
Exactly.
As you say very often, Bill, we need a God that tells us no, and that's why we got to crack our Bibles open, because a lot of times our conception of God, I'd say almost all the time, is different than the way he presents himself in the Word. And there are 10 commandments. They're not 10 suggestions. And we got to look at this and go, okay, I got to be all in on this. And you know what, Bill? Addicts are all in, guys. If we're going to go out, we're going to get our drug, our drink, our smokes, maybe a deck of cards, and we're all in on that. The only time we show any moderation at all is in our recovery and our walk. And where that starts is, hey, do you want to go do this to work with people? No, I don't. What I see with guys, they might start going to recovery gatherings and get invited out to eat with the people afterwards, and they go, no, I'm busy. Go. Because you need to develop new friendships and new relationships. One of our good friends, Paul S., that you know, who just got his 10-year medallion, the coolest guy I know, and probably the only real man I know, he jumps out of airplanes, climbs mountains. The rest of the guys are like me. We go to the club, play golf. We're not real men at all. Paul said that I asked him one time to come with me to help me speak to some guys. And I don't recall this. And he said, I don't know if I can. And he said, I told him, I'm not asking you. And he said, I got that. And he said, that changed my recovery. So when I work with guys, I tell them, I'm not asking you. You're doing it. And that's what we got to do. What God asks you to do something, it's in front of you. You ever think when you say no to something, you're saying no to Jesus?
Mm.
So that's what we got to do.
So, George, in step three, are you basically saying, I want to lose my individuality? Because I'm turning my will, my allegiance, my trust, and what I cling to over to Jesus.
Yeah, the first part, and there's a third step prayer that says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Remove from me the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties as victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And interestingly enough, Bill, there's no amen after that prayer in the textbook. And the reason for that is the work's going to begin now, and the amen comes after the seventh step prayer. So that's what you're doing, is you're offering yourself up and, you know, relieve mm-hmm. me of the bondage of self, because that's really what the problem is.
Yeah, George, what if you get to step three, but you don't find yourself quite ready to hand your life and the care to your higher power? Well, then what?
I believe that nobody is, because they don't know what it would entail. And one of the old sayings is act as if. And I know that helped me real early in recovery, was act like you're a Christian recovery guy. Quit acting like a junkie. Mm-hmm. And what that really gets to is the thought of what can I do for other people. It's real hard for us to go, okay, what do I do for God? I'll stay sober. I got that. But where you can really tell is what are you doing for other people? Because we go in a progression of our walk, the sanctification process, of not just committing offenses, but now we're going to stop doing that. We're going to look at what could I have done? What have I omitted in mm-hmm. my life? Where could I have helped somebody? And so we get from being selfish to what can I do for others? And we need God's help. But I know one of the miracles that happened in my life early in recovery, I finally got a year of sobriety, and it was a big deal. And I remember one of the guys I knew got a year about a month later, and I realized I was almost as happy for him, not totally, as I was for myself. And I thought, you know, something's happened to me. This was a competition. Life was a huge competition before. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And now there's some cooperation and some happiness for what other people are getting.
Yeah, George, what are or what were your greatest fears about giving up control over your life to God?
Well, the one I still have.
Which is?
I wouldn't sin if I didn't totally trust him. That it won't be as good as what I come up with. That's why we don't do it. I think any time we sin, well, I'll speak for myself, and I do it daily. I'm quite good at it. I'm choosing to do what I want to do rather than what God wants me to do, because mm-hmm. I think this will be better for me. And that really goes to a lack of trust. And any time we sin, I really think it's the first commandment, you shall put no other gods before me. I put myself as a god before him, and I think everybody else does the same thing when they sin.
Mm-hmm. Is giving your life over to God a one and done, or is it an ongoing event?
I wish it was a one and done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an ongoing thing.
Sure. We struggle with that all the time. I remember when I was program director of the Salvation Army, everybody needed to see me with a deep crisis on Friday afternoon when I was going home for the weekend. And I really had to battle with that in that it was my time. You know what I'm saying? I don't have my time. We have God's time. And I'm still very selfish, but I think what happens is the Holy Spirit convicts you, and you're aware of it now. You know, we're works in progress, Bill, and it's not a one and done.
Mm-hmm. After you, George, made your step three and gave your life over to God, what changes did you know in your heart you needed to make?
Oh, I needed to change everything.
Everything. So yeah. It was a complete reformatting of George F.
Well, we're still in progress on that. I think that's one of the things for people that's real hard about recovery is we think that our big problem is our using. Our big problem is us. And the text for recovery talks about our drinking is but a symptom, Bill. We have a heart problem. And as you said in the prayer before the show, you know, taking a heart of stone and making it a heart of flesh. I think that's out of Ezekiel. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it is.
Good guess. What do I get for that? Do I get a signed Bible?
Nothing.
Okay.
No. So
I hear music.
I know. We're coming to a break here, but I got to get one last quick question in. When you were doing your step three, did you understand the severity of your addiction?
No. And I would use addiction with my sinful heart.
Okay.
Yeah. No. And okay. I still underestimate it today.
Okay. That's a lot of honesty. All right. We're going to take a little break when we come back. Charles is in studio, and I'm not saying he's a high maintenance guest, but he's already asked for designer water with slices of cucumber in it. So that's what's next. Be back in a minute.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
All right, we are back, and we are now celebrating this month our ninth year of Real Recovery. We're awfully glad to be doing it and feel very blessed that God has given us this opportunity. And we pray that it is helping you in your addiction, your recovery, and that you're coming to understand it more and understand that we are sinful and in need of a Savior, regardless of where you are in your recovery journey. George, we got a great story tonight. I'm quite excited to have Charles in studio, despite some of his big demands up front.
Yeah.
I'm awfully glad to have him here.
Yeah, it's great to have him here. That was a great intro.
Thanks, George.
And the nine-year thing, I was just thinking over here. I know it's only an hour a week. This is the longest job I've ever had.
Come to think of it, yeah, this is,
you know, that's
this,
a
is a, this is a resume buster for you,
this
isn't
it? It is. Yeah. So we got a great show tonight. Yeah. We know this guy, and I really like him.
I do, too. Charles, are you enjoying your meat and cheese platter that
yes,
we
I
had
am.
To order specifically for you?
Thank you.
Yeah, you're
Thank
welcome.
You.
Talk about high maintenance, George.
Oh.
This is the first time this has happened.
Yeah.
You know. But anyway, Charles, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, George, why don't you ask the first question?
Okay. I'll ask the first question. Where were you raised?
I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. I can say basically all over Chicago. My mom had a drug habit, a crack habit, and couldn't hold down a place. So I was west side of Chicago. Mostly raised over the north side of Chicago, and then south side. I went to four different high schools because my mom couldn't, you know, hold down a place of residence. So went to four different high schools each semester. Freshman year, different high school. Sophomore year, different high school.
Cubs or White Sox?
I'm a White Sox fan.
South side?
Yeah.
Okay.
Frank Thomas.
Oh, yeah. The big herd, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. Charles, I don't see a lot of stability in your life. New high school every year.
It's hard to make friends.
I bet.
And
you're
then,
a friendly guy.
You could say.
Yeah,
somewhat.
You're definitely outgoing. I could see you making friends anywhere you went.
Yeah.
But it's not easy, is it? Just
no.
Ask George. He has no friends.
I thought you were my friend. Is that just fake for an hour a week?
Well, we work together. Let's just put it that
I'm
way.
I'm a colleague. That would be hard, though. You're moving all the time. And
moving all the time.
Were you lonely?
Well, not really. I had my sister, and then my mom's friend, she had three other kids. and they stayed with us too, and we all went to school together, and we just stayed around each other and kept each other company, you know.
Okay.
I stayed in the community a lot, just playing softball or going to a lot of community organizations and trying to stay active there and make friends there. And we couldn't go without, you know, our cousins, or I couldn't go without my sister, because it's pretty dangerous. But if you stay in a pack together, no one seems to really mess with you, you know.
Were you going to church at all?
Going to church a lot by ourselves. My mom didn't really go with, you know, she stayed at home. We went to a lot of churches, I can say. I think I shared this with you. Went to Baptist, went to Lutheran, went to Presbyterian, if I'm saying that right. Went to Christians, a lot of Christian organizations, just nightly things, just to get out the house and not be around all the drug activity.
A lot of drug activity around your house.
And, yeah.
Did that scare you as a kid?
Not really. My mom made us stay in our room most of the time. She threw a lot of card parties, you can say, and played loud music. So it was kind of hard to stay in the room, wanted to come out and see what they were doing out there. Didn't really, you know, experience, you know, like sneaking alcohol or sneaking cigarettes or anything like that. Just wanted to see what they were doing out there. We got sent to our room a lot, but sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes she would just see us and wouldn't say anything and let us hang out there and in the festivities.
Okay. So were you playing sports and stuff in school?
I was ROTC, cross guard, volleyball, softball. Really didn't go any further because my mom couldn't support the fees and the money that it took to travel and the money that it took to keep the uniforms and staying on the bus to be able to get bus fare. So
ROTC?
Yeah.
That's a first on Real Recovery, I think, Bill.
Well, I was ROTC as well, so.
No, you weren't.
You act so surprised, George. You don't even know me. Charles, I didn't think I could like you more, but I do like you more now, hearing the story. This is so unbelievable, because the relationship of mother is so sacred, and you love your mom, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But your mom is, she's in trouble.
Yes.
If she's using.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're kind of left to fend for yourself, and you're moving around the city a lot, different apartments all the time.
Yes.
Did you ever have any periods of homelessness where you guys were just between apartments? And
yeah, we had to be put out. We were evicted. And I just remember carrying all of our stuff, my cousins, my sister, my mom's friend, and my mom. And my mom's friend was carrying a 75-pound TV. Because they didn't want to give up their big TV. They gave up almost everything else, the furniture and everything. But mm-hmm. she was carrying this heavy TV, and we were walking to a shelter. Mm. And we were all carrying bags through Chicago. I think it was a Broadway. Walking to a shelter.
Yeah.
And back in those days, shelters aren't like they are now, where they'll come pick up people that have kids. You mm-hmm. had to actually find your own transportation to get there. Unless it was a battered women's shelter. And we stayed at battered women's shelters a lot. We traveled between Wisconsin and Minnesota and Chicago, like, most of my elementary year, because they couldn't hold down a place, so we'll go stay at relatives in Minnesota. We'll go, my mom will make up stories about being abused, and, you know, my dad's been dead for probably 25 years, mm-hmm. and when she was using that, he was probably dead for about 7 years. And she was just saying that she was being abused so she can get into a shelter. And they would take us all in. We'll be in a battered woman's shelter, and we would have to lie and say that we're going through this, and we really weren't at that time. When mm-hmm. we were going through it, my mom wasn't trying to go to a battered woman's shelter. She was trying to be there for my dad and act like everything was peaches and herbs.
Right.
Trying to make sure everything was all good, but then when she's not going through it, she wants to use that to get into a shelter so she wouldn't be on the street.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, you are shockingly normal to me. coming up with that? And I know that, you know, your recovery hasn't been 15 years, but you have a real inner strength about you. And some people are overcomers, Bill, and you're one of them. And it's really interesting to hear that. That's shockingly sad, but you're a survivor and an overcomer. And I can't wait to hear the rest of this story, Bill.
I can't either. And Charles, when I think of your family heading towards a homeless shelter, carrying your possessions in bags, I just have to say my heart just breaks. And largely because I've known you now for 6 months, and I did not know that was your history. And it's just so sweet that God has gotten a hold of your life. But having said that, I know there's more to the story.
you can say, just been around. I can say, I got tired of being in shelters and not having a stable place to live. So my mom sent me with my aunt, which she was well known in Chicago. She owned the cleaners. She was a lawyer. She had the better life. And she sent me to go stay with her. And that was the first time that I ran into drugs, to go stay with my aunt. And she despised drugs. She didn't want us to do them. She wanted us to stay working and go to school. But my cousin, my aunt's son, I could say, I don't know how you would put it, but a silver spoon kind of guy, homeschooled, never been around harm, never been around harm like I've been around harm. So he was very, very eager to be around it. So he was the one that introduced me into drugs, you know.
He introduced you to drugs.
Yeah, which was crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah, and he was doing it when I showed up, and I didn't mess with it the first week because I was kind of scared of it. And then also in the back of my mom said, if I touch drugs, she'll kill me. So that was really in the back of my head to not do it. But then after a while, that selfishness started kicking in, and then that self-righteousness started kicking in to where it was like, my mom's been doing drugs around me most of my life. Why, you know, should I listen to her now? You know, I want to hurt her, you know.
So sounds like an idle threat, doesn't it?
Yeah, so
yeah,
I'm...
If you use drugs, I'll kill you.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You've been using drugs my whole life.
Yes.
Yeah, but he held out a week. Bill.
Yeah,
I'm giving lots of credit. Trying to get his room settled in his new house. You know, what's the age between you and your cousin?
He was...
Older, younger?
14, and I was... 16.
Okay.
And he, how can I put it? I was a freshman in high school, and he was a junior in high school. So he was one of the smart kids in our family.
Yeah. All right. I think it's a good time to take a pause, and we got a lot more story coming up from Charles. And I'm so glad you're with us tonight. Thank you for listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We have Ted on the board, and Charles is our special in studio guests, so go nowhere. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Charles probably doesn't know this guitar riff, but George, you and I, that's
Steely Dan.
Steely Dan. Isn't and the song is?
Reeling in the Ears.
You got that right. Yeah. Get yourself a Dairy Queen on the way home.
Funny how I can remember some things from the party years. Huh?
Yeah, that was the 70s. All right, Charles is our in-studio guest, and what a story. Whenever I hear a story that starts with, so my cousin and I, usually it never turns out good.
No. No, it didn't.
That's true.
So tell me about your cousin introducing you to drugs.
What'd you do first?
Marijuana. And it just gave me the giggles and laughed a lot. And my cousin, probably who's been doing it way before he introduced it to me, was just so serious. He wasn't laughing. He was always telling me to calm down, stop being so giggly. And because we were around other people, and I guess I was the only one that was laughing, but it just made me feel giggly, and it made me feel no pain, you know, and it made me forget my mom, you know, because she was still in the shelter while I was staying with my aunt, and I didn't want to go with my mom to stay in another shelter. So I wanted to be normal, and staying with my cousin, knowing that he was raised around money, gave me a reason to stay. You know, she gave me everything that I thought I wanted. You know, I had all the clothes back in the day, from Echo to Sean John to Adidas to shoes, every once a month, regardless if I had good grades or not. But I kept good grades because I know that was one way that my aunt would continue to get me stuff. I worked at the cleaners after school. We always tried to get out of working at the cleaners so we can go get high and drink, you know.
So you're drinking too?
Oh yeah, we started drinking probably about a month later. We were drinking. Had people, it's very easy in Chicago. Just give someone an extra $5 or $10 of what you want, and they'll go in the liquor store and grab it for you and meet you around the corner and hand it off to you, and we'll go our separate ways. It's very easy in the cities. And we did that for a long time. I have to say, I went to Morgan Park for probably a year and a half of doing all that and being involved in drug activity and being affiliated with gangs, but not being a part of a gang because I was too scared to get jumped in or anything. But when you have family members that are gang members, you're a part of them, you know, if you want to or not, you know, because your family's a part of it, so they suspect that you're part of it too. It was an eye-opener, being around gang activity, and I have to say I was probably jumped maybe once or twice, but that was all because of my cousin and his mischief.
When you say jumped, Charles, do you mean you got somebody
beat up?
Got beat up.
A couple of times going to the store, and they knowing that was my cousin, so they would, you know, try to jump me, and
okay.
I would fight back, you know, but I still would say getting jumped because I'm not ready to fight you, so you're coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's like being jumped, you know. Even though I fought back, I still take it as being jumped because I didn't expect it, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. I have to say, my mom wound up getting a place in St. Francis, Minnesota after that, and she begged me to leave my aunt because she knew all about my cousin Jay.
Okay.
And how he was.
And did you leave?
Yes, I did. I have to say I left late 2000 and went to go stay with my mom. She paid for a ticket and everything. And my aunt was kind of mad about that, so she didn't let me take anything. None of my clothes, nothing, just the clothes on my back. And I got on and she dropped me off at the Greyhound and sent me back to my mom. I probably left that out, but my aunt's very money hungry. And if she can't get anything out of you, she wants nothing to do with you. And I didn't realize that when I was living with her. I realized it when I left and how she just let me leave with just the clothes on my back and nothing else. Went to go stay with my mom in St. Francis, Minnesota. Stayed there. She had a nice townhouse. But in St. Francis, Minnesota, the townhouses are known as projects because everyone in St. Francis has a three-story house. So everyone made it seem like where I was staying with my mom was the projects, but it was a really nice townhouse. It was just a large community of townhouses that were really nice. They just labeled it as the projects. And I went to St. Francis High School and I finished my senior year there in St. Francis, Minnesota. Population 1,500. It was a handful of black people. And when I say handful, it was a small handful. And I had mostly white friends. And graduated 2002, St. Francis High School. Crazy part is I had plans on going to culinary school and quitting. And I also was still doing smoking weed and still drinking. And I hung with the stoners because those were the people that I was comfortable with at St. Francis High School. And then once high school was over with, it's nothing to do. You know, I decided not to go to culinary arts at Brown College because I wanted to stay around my friends. I wanted to continue, you know, getting high and being around them. I didn't want to lose that friendship because, you know, from my past, it's hard to make friends. So once I had these group of people, I didn't want to leave. So I wound up staying there with them. And wound up getting introduced to methamphetamines. I have to say, early 2003, just bored at a house party, about 150, which is kind of crazy because St. Francis population is 1,500, so it was like being in a house party with about 150 to 200 people because the mom or dad went on a convention in California or New York somewhere, so they would turn the whole house into a house party, and I thought that was only in movies, you know, and to actually be involved in one to where it's a guy out there at the bonfire with long hair playing an acoustic guitar while all the girls are around him, and you got a keg stand, you got DJ, and you got people synchronized dancing. It was crazy, but that's exactly what it was. And I guess I got tired of smoking weed and drinking, but everybody kept going into this room, you know, and I'm wondering why they keep going into this room, coming out, you know, full of energy. And I'm like, man, when we're smoking and we're drinking, we're usually, you know, tired or laid back and not so full of energy. So I went into the room, and they were hitting a light bulb. Back in those days, it had to be a light bulb because it wasn't too many head shops around here where you could buy the products that you needed for methamphetamines. So they would smoke out of a light bulb. And I was looking at it. I was like, what are y'all doing? You know, kind of wigged me out. I was scared at first, you know. But then I have to say about maybe an hour or two later, I was convinced and I took a hit. And it just filled me with so much energy. The weed and the alcohol that I've been drinking probably for the past 8 hours just totally escaped my body. And this energy just overwhelmed me. And meth became my friend. It became, man, powerful over my life.
Do you think he got addicted first time he did it?
I have to say no. Because I do like uppers. I'm a upper king. I do like uppers, but I have to say no because I did it for probably a week, and then after that, the coming down part really sucks about methamphetamines. Once you stop doing it, if you don't have any more, the first 3 days are hell.
Okay.
Depression, hungry, and tired, and the depression is way overwhelming. Overwhelming to where you feel like you don't want to live, to where you don't want to be around anybody, you just want to isolate and sleep, but it's hard to sleep because you're so depressed.
So did you stop doing it, or did you realize you gotta keep doing it and so you don't get depressed all the time?
One thing about I'm learning about Charles is that I do things to hurt people. And I was involved in a intentional friendship with a girl, and I didn't know she liked me, and I wound up liking her, you know. But then in the long run, she wound up getting one of my best friends, and it really hurt me. And one thing I know about her, because we were friends so long, that she didn't like meth. So I thought, hey, you know, one way I can hurt her is, I guess I'll go ahead and smoke methamphetamines and let her know and do it in front of her, because she used to do it, but she stopped doing it. But I knew that she liked me a little bit. She was just with this guy because I didn't step up and get in a relationship with her. So she got with this other guy, and I thought, hey, if I use methamphetamines, this will hurt her how she hurt me by going with someone else. But in the long run, it took me some years to learn that I was just hurting myself. But that's the reason why I went back to doing meth, because...
How long did that streak go then?
About 2 years, man. 2 years of just stupidity.
Is that your whole lifestyle then? Is a meth guy? I mean,
you can say... I say after I left St. Francis, because the meth just was overwhelming and got too much into my life. I worked third shift, so I worked from 10 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. So that drug suited my work life as well. But I got caught sleeping on the table because I was up for 9 days in the break room of County Market. He came up. And I turned off the lights. I heard him buffing the floor because I would buff floors and clean floors for grocery stores. And I heard him buffing the floors. I said, okay, I'll get a nice 15, 20-minute nap in. Lights was off, but when I woke up, all the lights were on. So obviously he came up there and turned the lights off and seen me sleeping on the table, and he fired me. And after that, it just went downhill. I lost everything, the place where I was living. I was living with the girl that I was hurting by smoking meth, her dad let me sleep, let me rent a room out of his house. That's also one thing about me too. I get in a relationship with your parents really, really good. I become real good friends with your parents. Even if you and me weren't friends anymore, George, I would make sure to be good friends with your mom and dad. So if I needed a place to lay my head, I would be leave it to Beaver to them. But to you, you know the real me, but you wouldn't put that or portray that in front of your mom because, how can I put it? Because you don't want them to know that you are bad, that you have a bad side as well too. So you wouldn't let them know about my bad side. You just let me continue being fake in front of your parents. So when I needed a place to lay my head or when you and me were going through bad times, you say, hey, we're not friends anymore. Okay, but I'll be at your house sitting there talking with your mom and your dad when you come home from work or school. So I was really manipulative when it came to that. So yeah, her dad let me stay. Her dad let me stay there and live, even though she was still with the guy that I didn't want her to be with. But he let me rent a room out of there.
So you're doing meth and you lost your job.
Yes.
So where'd you go then? Did you come to the cities?
Yes. He found out and that I was smoking meth and everything, and he said I had 30 days to get out. I left within like maybe a week or two, and went back to go stay with my sister in Chicago. She had a place, and one thing about me too also is when I'm in my addiction, I don't want nobody to know what I'm doing or how I'm doing. So I don't call. I haven't called my sister in almost 5 years when I went to go stay with her this time to mm-hmm. get away from meth, and she just welcomed me in. You know, I don't talk to anybody because I want to talk to you because I'm doing something good, but when I'm doing things bad, I don't want you to know what I'm doing or how I'm going.
Sounds pretty typical, George, doesn't it?
Yep.
All right, let's take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery. Charles is our guest in studio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George. Charles is our guest. Amazing story, Georgie boy.
Shocking. I know the guy, and I didn't know any of this. How about you?
I'm a little surprised, to be honest. Yeah. When I met Charles, he was very thoughtful and intentional, like he is now. But I got right away that he was serious about his recovery.
Absolutely.
And he wanted to make a difference. He wanted to make a change. And he was taking his relationship with Christ very seriously.
That's the guy I know.
Yeah, it's the guy I know, too.
So I'm kind of wondering how we got to be that guy.
Yeah, let's find out. Charles, so, what do you say?
I have to say, when I came into the Salvation Army, ARC, I was coming down and coming off of meth, cocaine, weed, and alcohol. And I left Wisconsin from staying with my sister in Janesville, Wisconsin, and I had to come here because I knew the ARC, Salvation Army, was the one place that helped me stay sober two other times. But those two other times, I wasn't too serious. This time, I was all in. I decided to give it my all and do everything that I needed to do to complete this program and to actually, I have to say, find God. I thought I found him the other two times I graduated from this program, but I was just playing around and it was like a persona, you know, like a mirage. Like I was just trying to, you know, be who they wanted me to be so they could see me as something that I really wasn't. But this time, man, I was all in. I was all in this time. I did things that I didn't want to do. I got a sponsor. I went to more AA meetings than I wanted to. I went to them because I needed to go to them. And then also, I loved church. You know, just like I said before, when I was little, we would go to church communities. But I loved church at the ARC. I like singing, but God's music. You know, I used to sing secular music, but that wasn't really my forte. I like singing God music now. I like worshiping. I like praising God. I sing for the ARC right now on stage Wednesdays and Sundays. And I enjoy it, man. It brings the real me out. that I keep bottled up because I'm ashamed of that person.
You Charles, know? You got a little a cappella for us right now, just a little verse or two, a little sample of those golden pipes, or is that just putting you way too on?
Oh,
that's
putting me too much on the spot.
I'm not going to do that. I want to be nice. I want to be nice and hospitable on Real Recovery. That's why we're in our ninth year.
To the guest.
Yeah, to the guest, not the co-host.
Yeah, there's a clarification there.
Yeah.
No, but yeah. I'm really not prepared for that.
That's cool.
But,
just, you know, you never know.
So, you know, he said that's the real him when that happens. When we're walking with God, that is the real identity of us, isn't it?
Yes.
And this time at the ARC, you've taken it seriously.
Yes.
Well, what changes has that made besides the singing twice a week on stage and going to recovery meetings and church, and what else have you done?
Following God and letting him control my life, even though I like to step in and take over sometimes, but I got to realize I mess up things. He's brought my daughters back into my life. I have a 12-year-old, Belinda Monet Cloak, and I have a 3-year-old about to be 4, Leticia Sandra Marie Cloak, and brought them back in my life. When I decided to be in their life, they wanted nothing to do with me, but now that I'm, you know, doing everything possible to do what God's will is for my life, they're slowly and surely coming back to wanting to be a part of their dad's life. I'm also Salvation Army soldier. I was one in 2014, but I walked away because of my own selfish and self-seeking needs. But now I'm a Salvation Army with or without the uniform on. You know, back in 2014, you wouldn't have been able to tell me that if I had the uniform on. Do you know who I am? You know, now it's just a uniform, and I see that that's just what it is, you know. But the real save to serve guy is the one that's talking right now, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to keep that guy. You know, I don't want to lose him. I don't want to lose the person that I am today. And my sponsor lets me know that. I'm pretty sure y'all know who he is, old good old Glenn Rank.
He is old.
Yeah. Yeah. He's
you're younger than I am. Yeah,
he sees through my bull crap. He sees that what I'm telling him, he sees through it and tells me what I don't want to hear, and that's a big thing, and I needed that, you know what I mean? And I love coming to Thursdays to hear George speak, and I love Fridays to hear Bill Arnold at the ARC. I go out of my way to make sure that my workout's done and everything is done so I can come to his class on Fridays.
See, I would have made sure I got my workout in. So.
Really?
Yeah.
You just can't let him talk, George?
No.
You have to interject at this point?
And I will be honest, I missed a few of George's classes, but I'm...
To work out? Yeah.
So, but
not Friday when Bill's here. Yeah, I can't miss that. Yeah.
But I do see you on Monday at the alumni meeting, so that makes it up. So. Yeah. But other than that, man, just I'm involved in the ARC. I'm involved at Noble Church in Brooklyn Park. I love being involved. I always wanted to be a part of something. Being a part of the Salvation Army is really giving me a sense of belonging. And then also, you know, I have plans and further expectations. Well, as we were saying in the car, goals. And I want to go to the training college. I want to further my pastoral skills and, you know, have God shine me up to be who he wants me to be and send me wherever he wants to send me. And that's one of the goals of in my life, to go to the training college.
You know, Charles, maybe you could speak to what it's like when you present an imposter to the world, because you've done that before, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I think all of us at one point have had that as a temptation, or we've done it in reality, where you present to the world something that you're not.
Oh, yes.
So how do you, what counsel could you give people that are living that double life where they know their truth, yet they're presenting to the world something that's not them?
Oh, yes. I'm still working on that. I'm in the process of flushing that out of my system, but I still find myself doing that when it comes to women, you know, because I'm a great manipulator too. I'm also a drug addict and alcoholic, but I'm also a manipulator. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell myself that I'm quick to tell you what you need to hear.
Gotcha.
You know, to get what I want. Mm-hmm. But I have to pull back sometimes and let myself know that that's not me. I'm not ready for that. You know, so I have to say this is my first recovery and my first treatment without being in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quick to manipulate a woman to be in a relationship
right,
and let
right.
her know, you know. So, yeah.
George, it's romance and finance, isn't it?
it always is, and that can be another drug for us.
Yeah.
You know, the money and the relationship. But when we're walking with God, the godly relationship
yes.
is different. I know what you're laughing at. Why would I present this to the public?
I get that.
Right.
But, you know, but we learn that in stages, and God brought him back a couple times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And you realize that once you start looking back, it's like, I got another chance. I mean, I wasn't all the way into it. And most people aren't, Bill. It comes in stages. I'm not going to give up everything. Come on. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you start walking with God, and nothing else compares to that. You want more of it. You want to work with guys. He wants to go to training college.
Yeah.
God's plan for your life's a lot better than yours was.
Oh, yes. Very much. Way different.
Yeah. Charles, I'd like to back up just a little bit to your graduate from high school. You're a senior, and you've got plans to go to culinary school, which would have been awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And what you said in the last half hour was, I didn't want to leave my friends that you were using with. Did it ever occur to you that you might make new friends at culinary school, which would have been healthy friends?
Maybe.
Which would have been... I know, I'm just speculating, George.
I was afraid of starting over,
okay.
And I've started over so many times,
yep.
Freshman,
I
sophomore,
get that.
Junior.
Yeah, I get that.
Know. Yeah, I know, but I wish I would have furthered my culinary skills, because all these cooking shows that are on TV now, I see myself in them, but it's...
You should hang around George. He can make a 7-course meal using only a toaster. It's very impressive.
That's a talent. No, and you know, Bill, we're going to find people to hang out with. You've raised a really good point. And now you've got some guys that, you know, the Bible talks about bad company corrupts good character.
Oh, yeah.
Iron sharpens iron, so one man another. And you're doing that now, working with guys at the Army. You're a soldier. You went AWOL for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Did 6 months in the brig, graduated. But what I'm always interested to hear, Bill, is he graduated, but he still comes back on Friday to hear you. He goes back on Monday for an alumni deal. Those are the guys that make it. They keep that as part of their life.
Suit up and show up. Makes a big difference, doesn't
yep.
it?
And yep.
you never know what you're going to learn and how you're going to be helping somebody else. Right?
Yeah.
You know, surprise me, God.
Yes.
I say surprise me every week. What do you got for me?
And I try to.
I know. And you do a fairly good job.
Yeah, it's disappointing a lot of times. But it's really interesting to look at. If you want to know how you're doing, look at what you're doing. And you're showing up, as Bill said, you know, you go back and you're working with guys and you're doing the workouts. You go to the Y.
Yes, yes.
And you got a good life. And why would you want to go back to using when you have or your recovery's better? Glenn always says, I don't want to lose the guy that I am today.
Yes, yes.
And you've got that.
Well, Charles, I hope you've had fun today.
Oh, yeah.
Doing real recovery.
Tonight,
that's right.
And the cucumber water was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you're welcome. And the cheesy meat platter, it was not cheap. That wraps up another award-winning show of Real Recovery. Thank you for listening and supporting Faith Radio. I know you probably have a friend who would benefit from hearing this, so you can go to myfaithradio.com. Go to the Real Recovery show page, and you can email this episode on to your friends, because I know you have many. Thanks again for being with us tonight. Have a great week, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.